From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Alternative facts, when they happen in science, how do you know what's true?
One of the lessons that I would want to draw about this is the importance of fostering more transparency in science, more openness to data and methods and deliberations.
Why local governments and school districts are wrestling with unfunded pension liabilities.
Their assumptions have been too rosy. They have been assuming that retirees won't live as long as they do. Their health care costs cost more.
And it's maple syrup time.
And on average, it takes 40 gallons of sap. You remove 39 gallons of water, and you end up with 1 gallon of syrup.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was the verbal tug of war that thrust that term alternative facts into our vocabulary. NBC's Chuck Todd grilling White House counselor Kellyanne Conway over the Trump administration's insistence on inflating crowd size at the president's inauguration.
Excuse me, it does not excuse, and you did not answer the question.
I did answer your question.
No, you did not. You did not answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office on day one.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered.
Chuck,
was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Yes, what a moment. But pushing out alternative facts isn't new, and it's not just in the arenas of politics and the media. It's been happening in the scientific arena for decades. And that's something Kevin Elliott wants to warn us about as we all read about the latest new scientific breakthrough or research. Kevin is an associate professor of philosophy at Michigan State University in the Lyman Briggs College and the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. And with us now, Kevin, let's start with that very term, alternative facts. What does that phrase mean to you?
Yeah, well, as I think we can gather from that clip, it's sort of a euphemism for basically a falsehood. The suggestion is trying to spin something that's really not true and give it this label of alternative facts. And so I thought it was really interesting and an opportunity to extend this topic from the political context and think about how this has happened in the sciences as well.
And you've done an analysis of case studies of alternative facts in science. What were you looking at? Before we talk about the examples, what were you actually looking at?
My interest in this came from, and I'm, of course, not the first person to do this. There's a lot of really interesting work that historians of science and philosophers of science have been doing, looking at basically this kind of phenomenon historically. And part of the motivation was our current situation with climate change, trying to understand why there was so much conflict or confusion about the phenomenon. And so they sort of looked back historically and have provided some context for the confusion that we have now. And that's sort of how I got interested in this.
So give us some of the prominent examples of alternative facts pushed out to the public in the arena of science.
Probably the classic example that people often go back to that's perhaps the most striking is that of the tobacco industry that a lot of us are familiar with, where back in the 1950s, when it was becoming pretty clear that there was strong evidence that smoking caused lung cancer, and the tobacco companies were really worried about this and met with a prominent public relations firm and developed a whole set of strategies for trying to convince the public that there wasn't actually so much of a problem. And in some of their internal documents, they actually have this line that doubt is our product. They didn't have to convince the public that it was definitely safe, but if they could just raise doubts that this could be tremendously helpful for them. And so they provided kind of a model that then other industries have used since then. The chemical industry in Michigan, we're all familiar with the Flint situation. The lead industry used a number of these same strategies. And there's a wonderful book by a couple historians of science called Merchants of Doubt. And they've actually traced some of these same public relations firms and scientists and strategies through tobacco and then casting doubt on acid rain and then the ozone hole and now climate change. So it's a really fascinating historical story.
And even as we're talking, a very recent development was about Roundup, the Monsanto, one of the biggest product, the weed killer. And a judge has ordered documents to be unsealed, and they really raise questions about the safety of Roundup and the research practices that Monsanto has used in it.
Yeah, that's another excellent example where actually one of the lessons that I would want to draw about this is the importance of fostering more transparency in science, more openness to data and methods and deliberations. And I think that applies both in the industry sector where there are concerns, these same kinds of concerns in the pharmaceutical industry where we may not be getting access to all the data that they have, that they may be somewhat selective in what they publish and make known. And like you pointed out, in the Roundup situation, I don't know all the details there, but it illustrates these worries that we may not be privy to all the information that we would really like to have out there and available to the public.
And even in terms of perhaps not as nefarious an attempt as we saw, for example, as you cited in the tobacco industry, where all of that internal stuff was certainly augmented with ads, because we can all remember those ads from the 40s and 50s showing doctors, sketches of doctors in white coats smoking cigarettes and recommending. So they worked closely with their advertisers. But also when we think of the media, of reporters reporting on scientific studies, and everything sounds like the biggest new breakthrough. And we as the consuming public have to take that with a big grain of salt, don't we?
Yeah. And actually, I really like your point that it's not all nefarious, because you have certain cases that are just really striking where you had, for example, the tobacco industry just flat out lying. But then you have much more subtle things. And, you know, I gave a talk about this recently at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And this was in a day-long seminar where they were discussing concerns in academic science, where you may not have such striking financial conflicts of interest, but you still have pressures because of the desire to publish, to get attention for work, to get further grant funding, that there's just incentives to put out the latest finding. And, you know, when you get negative findings that aren't so striking, there's not that pressure to publish, and it may even be difficult to publish. And so there are just these natural incentives that, you know, we find out about certain information and don't about others. And so this is really important, as you point out, for us as the public, that, you know, if we see some new study that just came out, we don't want to overly emphasize that. We really want to get a sense of what's the overall sense of the scientific community and what's the overall set of information in multiple studies. So that's a great point.
That's the challenge for those of us who are reporters, to get that context and not just jump with whatever press release the university or the science center puts out.
And I think that, you know, it is exciting that I think the media has started to become more sophisticated. A classic example, again, is climate change, where there was a very definite strategy on the part of some of the industry to, when you had climatologists come out and talk about climate change, for them to find somebody to try to give an opposing perspective. And initially, I think the media, because of their effort to be balanced, fell into this trap of just presenting both sides. And I think the media has become more savvy, realizing if 97% of the peer-reviewed papers are emphasizing that, you know, human actions and greenhouse gases are contributing to climate change, and there's just this tiny little minority, often who aren't climate scientists, who are questioning this, well, then it's actually not balanced to give both sides equal attention. And so I'm excited to see the media starting to become more sophisticated and careful about that.
Kevin, is there a risk that even as by having this conversation, we undermine trust in sound science?
You know, I think there's always the potential, but I think that we all really want to develop a public that's more sophisticated in terms of their perspectives on science. And I think we all recognize that, you know, that science is a gradual process, that it builds up, that, you know, we can't just trust single studies. And so I think it's overall a good thing for the public to recognize that science is a complicated process and that they shouldn't just accept the latest idea. But it's also really important to remember the value of organizations like the National Academy of Sciences that comes out with really solid reports that give a good sense of the overall state of opinion. And so if I were offering advice to the public, I would say really give weight to the kinds of reports coming out of these established, respected scientific organizations. And we don't want to just sort of dismiss the scientific community as a whole. We just want to be thoughtful in our responses to science.
And to that point, more advice. I want you to give more advice to consumers, to the people who are reading, maybe finding some hope in some of these reports, sharing them on Facebook or tweeting them out. What are the litmus tests we should apply as we, the public, read about the new scientific research so we can sort out the alternative facts from sound science?
Yeah. And I want to acknowledge that this isn't always easy for the public. Mm-hmm. And that's where I do think that the media can play a really valuable role in sort of helping to give a sense of sort of key reports and, you know, the perspectives of the scientific community as a whole. Of course, there are certain, you know, basic things the public can do. Obviously, it's always more important to appeal to peer-reviewed publications than those that aren't. There are journals that are really well-respected, like Science and Nature and, you know, the Journal of the American Medical Association and so on. But as we were talking earlier, you know, any individual publication, you know, we don't want to put too much weight in. So like I mentioned, these, you know, organizations like in the UK, the Royal Society, or in the US, the National Academy of Sciences, getting a sense of the scientific community as a whole. And I would also say to just, I think the public can educate themselves, you know, through, you know, books like Merchants of Doubt and so on, to realize there are these efforts to confuse the public and to create, you know, think tanks and, you know, front groups that sound good, that have good names, but that are actually, you know, trying to present this sort of skewed message. And I acknowledge it's not always easy. And this is where we need the media to really help us filter this information.
Guarding ourselves against alternative facts in science. Calvin Elliott is an associate professor of philosophy at Michigan State University. His book is A Tapestry of Values, An Introduction to Values in Science. It was great talking with you, Kevin, with great advice. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's sugaring season in Michigan. So did that burst of warm weather we had a few weeks ago give maple syrup producers anything to worry about? It's a pretty valid question. Michigan is number 5 in the nation for producing maple syrup. The Michigan Maple Syrup Association tells us that maple syrup's adding about $2.5 million to Michigan's economy every year. Kirk Hedding is here with us. He owns H&H Sugar Bush in Chelsea. Welcome, Kirk.
Thank you.
Am I right that there is a real art to knowing exactly when to tap your trees? It's not a matter of, hey, here's the date, we should do it now.
Yeah, there's definitely no set date. It's a lot of guesswork, a lot of paying attention to weather, and definitely taking the chance of throwing your taps in. You don't want to miss runs because normally the season's 4 to 6 weeks long, so it's a very short season for making our product. So if you miss a few runs, you definitely miss making some syrup.
And when you say miss a few runs?
The sap flow, when the sap is coming out of the roots of the trees and start going up towards the branches to form the leaves that they use the nutrients for, the sap. You're looking for that sap run going back and forth up and down the tree.
What happens if you start too early?
If you start too early, it's usually not the biggest deal, but you could actually lose out on late runs because the after you drill a hole in the tree, it's just like us being cut. They want to start healing as soon as they can. So again, that's that 4 to 6 week window, sometimes a little bit later, that the hole stays open enough that sap will still flow. So if you start tapping too early, the holes could dry up eventually also.
So you're missing out on product you could be getting.
At the end.
And then what happens if you wait too long?
If you wait too long, you just might miss it all. You just 3-4 years ago, I think we went straight to almost 80 degrees in March.
Okay.
And yeah, it was a 3 week. Like I said, average of 4 to 6 weeks. Well, when you get that average, that means you got some lower weeks too. So had 3 weeks.
That was we all remember that was a truly horrible year. If you grew cherries or apples,
yes.
Fruit people really took a hammering that year.
Yes.
So what about this bump we had at the beginning of March? Was that of concern?
The bump as in with the warm temperature.
70, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we started making some good syrup then. Mm-hmm. Not so much worried. Southern Michigan, we have a tendency to tap late February, make most our syrup the couple first 2-3 weeks of March, and then, of course, slow down late March. Of course, the farther you go up late in Michigan, a little bit later in the season you go. Some people have had great seasons this year. Our particular operation in southern Michigan seems to be around that two-thirds of a crop made. So lower than average, you go up a little bit more north where they didn't get as big of a bump. They got a nice bump is what they got out of it, and they've been making a good amount of syrup up there.
What's the process of actually making the syrup that we put on our French toast or our pancakes?
So the easiest aspects of it is you could collect sap, and on average it takes 40 gallons of sap. You remove 39 gallons of water, and you end up with 1 gallon of syrup. That's the real simple terms of it.
And it's done by boiling it off?
We boil. That is the main way of doing it. Back in the Native Americans starting it a long time ago, that's what they did. They boiled. And that's what we still do. You always have to boil it. We do incorporate more new technology into it, reverse osmosis machines, remove a lot of water from the sap for us before we start cooking it. Saves a lot of fuel and time in the long run. When you're heating that much, we use firewood. It's one of the number one ways of cooking is using firewood. Fuel oil is the number two. And it's a lot of fuel that you go through. So the reverse osmosis machine runs off electricity, and it processes it a lot faster to remove the sap. You still have to cook it down because the good flavors that you expect from maple syrup and the nice colors from it, the tans and the dark browns and stuff, that comes from the cooking of the sugars in the sap that start to caramelize. And as we do with cooking, caramelizing sugars brings out different flavors for as long as you cook it, different flavors come out.
Now, I'm real interested how you got into this because I don't know where anybody goes to get a bachelor's in maple syrup production. How did you learn this?
Well, internet is a wonderful thing and a dangerous thing. My wife and I started 11 years ago now. We started off with 10 taps. And
what drew you to it? What was the thing?
We actually were camping, and we bought some maple syrup at a farmer's market. We loved it. Neither one of us had had it before. We all raised in log cabin and Aunt Jemima syrup.
Yes, right.
And we're just like, that's a lot better. And then, of course, you start researching. It's like, well, that's even better for me than the other stuff. Then, of course, you look and it's like, well, how do you make it? And then it's like, do I have any trees? And so we went from 10 taps, and now we're up to 1,800, almost 2,000 taps.
How much do you produce? How many gallons?
Every year is different. Every year
ballpark
could be 400 to 600 gallons a year for our operation.
You know, I think about what you're describing, and many of us grew up reading the Little House books, the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, and of all the stories she tells, the pig slaughtering when she was a little girl watching Ma and Pa do that, and when they were in the Wisconsin woods doing the maple syrup just is branded in my brain.
Correct.
Stop and think. You're carrying the torch. You're doing something that the First Peoples did and carrying it on. Do you think about that?
Oh, all the time. Everybody asks, where did this start? And we all go back to those stories and we all look at Native Americans back in those days. They actually made maple sugar out of it. So they just cooked it down longer, removed more water. It was more stable for them. That way it wouldn't spoil. They could take it wherever they want because they didn't have refrigeration, a lot less to carry around. And it just has transformed throughout the years of what we needed in society-wise. You know, beet sugar, cane sugar is a lot cheaper to produce. So, maple sugar wasn't as prominent back then. So a lot of people like the health aspects of the maple sugar, which, again, it's just it's a easy process of removing water from sap. That is it.
And there you have it.
Exactly.
So would you, if you were grading this year as far as the kind of production you're going to get, what would you, A being, oh my goodness, we've never been better, and F being, this is horrible. Where are you?
For southern Michigan, we're probably around a C-, I'm going to say. We've had worse, and we've definitely had a lot better. As you expand your operations, you always have learning curves and stuff like that as you get bigger. Until you stabilize, then you can start really go year to year to figure things out. But this year, just it seemed like you put as much work in as normal, but you got two-thirds of a crop.
So as all farmers do, you just say, well, we'll wait till next year.
Exactly, yeah.
Kirk, great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
That's Kirk Hedding, who owns H&H Sugarbush in Chelsea. Grocery store shelves, restaurant menus, cookbooks, they're a lot different in 2017 than they were, say, 30 or 40 years ago. We tend to pay a lot more attention to the food we eat and how it's prepared. We know more about fine wines. Lots of us seek out organic fruits and vegetables, and we are willing to try exotic foods that our parents or grandparents couldn't even imagine. But at the same time, as all this is happening, we've seen the income inequality gap widen. So has good food become conflated with high status? That's the focus of a new book. It's titled Discriminating Tastes, written by Margot Finn. She's a lecturer in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan, where she specializes in food, popular culture, and class. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the subtitle of this book is really intriguing, How Class Anxiety Created the American Food Revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, really, it's the idea that class and class anxieties are driving this interest in food that you just described. So the reason that so many people started eating, trying to eat better in all these different ways, which often conflict, right? When you think about, we're going to buy imported wine and cheese, but local produce, or we're going to have gourmet meals, but we're also going to diet, right? There's these things that are kind of at loggerheads. So part of my curiosity going into writing this book was why all of these different ways of eating better, especially ones that don't seem to make sense with each other. And the common thread that I found in looking at the way people were talking about these foods and choosing them seemed to be that it was about status, about these anxieties about, and not necessarily always directly about class, but I think class is at the heart of that desire to eat better, to do better.
That old saying, you are what you eat. Is that what we're talking about here?
In a way, I think it, particularly to the extent that that saying reflects for people. Some people use it in a way to talk about health specifically, but I think the meaning of the phrase can be quite broad. The idea that, if you know how somebody eats, you know a lot of things about them, their background. And often by background, we really do mean class. But, you can also tell other things about people, their ethnicity, their region, sometimes their religion. There's other things that shape our foodways. But yeah, I think a central part, particularly right now in this moment of extreme income inequality, is that food really says something about your class status.
So you're what? By going and buying expensive organic produce or the best wines, are you saying I'm better than them? And if so, who's the them?
I think there is an act of differentiation at work, particularly with those luxury foods. But one of the trends that I find really fascinating is, and this has been talked about in music too, but in food, we've seen a move towards omnivorousness. So it's not just, the rich people are going to eat all the expensive fancy foods. Often now people express their status by saying that, I eat everything, right? I like everything. And I think part of what's going on there is it's a disavowal of snobbery. It's a move away from this kind of old school, the rich eat, all the fancy stuff. Now people are going to, they might have the fancy wine, the fancy cheese. Sometimes they'll go to the expensive restaurants, but they're also, and they're going to be really proud of this, right? They're going to go find the most exotic underground food. They're going to eat the food truck. They're going to find the pop-up. They're going to talk about how they really actually love American cheese. And that in some ways is a way of justifying, like, look, it's not just that I'm a snob. I like good food wherever it's from. So it's that kind of gesture towards a democratic taste. But I think that omnivorous itself is in some ways now a sign of status. Because if you're truly poor or don't have the ability to kind of seek out this whole range of things, then you're not going to have an omnivorous diet, right? You're not going to be able to signal your breadth of taste. You might have actually a very limited parochial taste that's governed more by you got to eat what's familiar, what's available to you. And you don't have the option of, I'm going to try this thing, and if I don't like it, I'll just not finish it, because you don't have the luxury of just throwing away money on food you might not like. So I do think that it's not just about the fancy stuff, but different ways that even just, having a whole range of tastes might signal that you've got privilege.
I'm talking with Margot Finn, who's a lecturer in applied liberal arts at the University of Michigan. Her book is Discriminating Tastes, How Class Anxiety Created the American Food Revolution. What are the four ideals of the food revolution?
The four that I talk about primarily are the idea of sophistication, and so that's the kind of fine wines and cheeses. The ideal of thinness, which I think is really central to our perceptions of what is healthy. The idea of purity, which by that I'm talking about the kind of natural foods movement. And the reason I use the word purity is in part because that was used in the Gilded Age to talk about some of the same concerns, ideas about food that is free of pathogens, and also that might, the kind of whole grains movement of that moment, I think, goes along quite nicely with the trend towards an organic, natural idea about food, local, sustainable, all that kind of gets encapsulated by the term purity. And the fourth would be cosmopolitanism, or the interest in diverse ethnic foods.
In fact, speaking of this historic parallels, you dig into the Gilded Age. So compare and contrast for us.
Sure. Well, what was fascinating to me is I think maybe like some other people, when I got into this project, I thought that all of these trends that I was talking about were pretty new. I thought that these were, you know, maybe there were some inklings in the 80s, but it was really the 90s where it got big. And before that, you know, we had, I don't know, processed cheese and cake mixes and whatever.
I am a child of the 50s, and I remember the green Jell-O cubes with the weird things in there. And,
yeah, Jell-O salads, casseroles, the kind of, you know, that we had kind of down home American cooking, and then it was in the 80s that we take off with all this fancy stuff. But when I looked at a longer historical timeline, it turned out that in, you know, roughly the period 1880 to 1920, a lot of the things that seem very familiar to us in terms of concerns, although they might have manifested differently, were really mainstream, and they were particularly a concern for the upper middle classes. So you see people starting to give really elaborate dinner parties with multiple courses, often, you know, with nods to French cuisine in that period. You also see the real emergence of weight loss dieting in America in that period. So people, and slimming was the term typically used at the time. So slimming diets were big. You also saw the pure foods movement emerge, right? People being really concerned about where their food is coming from and is it clean? Whole grain diets. And you also saw ethnic food, people getting really excited about different kinds of ethnic foods. There were Japanese teas were a popular way to entertain, particularly for the upper middle class. So there's a kind of, you know, people now talk about it as Orientalism, a real interest in the East, but it was broader than that too. There was an interest in all kinds of ethnic foods and having these cosmopolitan dinners that would showcase your geographical knowledge.
How did we retreat? Was it World War II? Was it the Depression?
I think it's the Depression. Mm. I mean, I would think that because I think it's tied to inequality, and it's really the Great Depression that crashes the fortunes of the ultra rich and where you see the compression in income inequality. But I do think that all of these and other historians who look at food have argued that these things do seem to recede at that moment. You do see a decline in the popularity of slimming, even. So weight loss dieting declines, and you get changes in beauty ideals, right? So there was kind of the flapper and the Gibson girl slimmer figures, and then we get a return to the more voluptuous body. So you do see this kind of, you know, I think 30s to 70s, you had a real retreat from all of these trends.
So where might this phase we're in go? Where do you see it going?
I hate predicting the future. So I started writing this dissertation around 2007, 2008, so right before the big financial crash. And I haven't been able to devote a lot of attention to what has changed since then. It's always hard to analyze your contemporary moment. I do think that probably it may have changed some things. And at the same time, because income inequality hasn't shrunk at all, my feeling is that there's still actually a lot of pressure to aspire through your consumption practices, that people are still not gaining, the middle classes in general are not gaining economically. So that there's still those kinds of, the same kinds of pressures that have existed since 1980, I think, are still weighing on the middle classes. So I don't know if it's really changing, but would it? I guess my prediction would be if we can shrink inequality, then we might see less concern about eating better in those kinds of ways. That would be my prediction. Yeah. But I don't know if inequality is going to shrink.
Fascinating stuff. And it makes you stop and think about what it is you reach for when you go shopping or when you're eating out. And just the one other thing I wondered, how much of it is just someone who's trying to choose to eat healthy because we know so much more than we did 3-4 decades ago about disease and what can cause disease. How much of that is I just want to be healthy, not so much that I'm trying to prove I'm better or kind of flaunt it a little bit?
I would say for individuals, it might often be, and I think this is true of, you know, whether you're trying to eat something that you think is tastier, whether it's healthy, whether you want to really explore some kind of other ethnic cuisine. I don't think it's coming from a place of like, oh, I'm going to show off, right? Not consciously, explicitly. But with the health thing, I think it is interesting that I think a lot of people are trying to eat healthy, and it is based on having some pieces of information, but it's not like there's one coherent, you know, I don't know that any of us really know what it is that we could eat to have optimum health.
Oh, I agree. In fact, you know, the diet plans come out in there and at loggerheads with each other quite often.
Look at paleo versus vegan, right? Or the plant-based diet. So I think that there is no one ideology that, and even nutritionists, people who study this don't necessarily agree all the time on what exactly it is we should eat. So I don't think that these trends, any of them, including the health food trend, is really driven by an enlightenment, right? Like, oh, now we know better than we did 30 years ago. We know some things that we didn't know 30 years ago, but I don't think it's translated into, I know exactly what I could eat to be healthier.
A great and fascinating look at the food we eat, the choices we make. The book is Discriminating Tastes, How Class Anxiety Created the American Food Revolution. Margo Finn, lecturer in Applied Liberal Arts at the University of Michigan. Great to talk with you.
Thanks so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities.
The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
What makes a region or a city a hotbed of innovation? The next idea's Jeff DeGraff thinks a big part of that is diversity. And as the U.S. makes that harder to achieve, he's worried that potential fuel for American innovation may be heading to the north of us.
A recent headline in the Financial Times read, "Vancouver sees his chance to lure Silicon Valley tech talent." The mayor of Vancouver confirms that inquiries from U.S. tech companies have risen sharply in recent months. It's no secret that Cisco Systems, Samsung, and SAP have recently established a presence north of the border. But now it appears that Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Facebook are all also considering their options. If this tire-kicking becomes a trend, it will compromise America's ability to remain a global leader in technology. According to a study in a recent California Management Review, the re-urbanization of America and other parts of the world is leading the collaborative innovation revolution. The demographics of these cities are very different than those of their surrounding areas. Austin, Madison, Raleigh-Durham, and Ann Arbor come to mind. These cities are also job-creating juggernauts that build a strong tax base and attract service businesses and more startups. They are innovation ecosystems that are vital to sustaining a high standard of living in a competitive world. What do these cities have in common? They are highly diverse. Diversity is an essential element of an innovation ecosystem because it brings a wide range of mindsets and talents into close proximity. The constructive conflict produces solutions to intractable challenges and creates irresistible opportunities. These people are deviating from the norm on purpose. The greater the variance, the greater the potential value. In Eric Weiner's bestseller, The Geography of Genius, he makes the case that most of what we would now call intellectual property has historically come from a relatively small group of people who are in the same right place at the same right time. Think Athens in the classical period, the Florentine Renaissance, Detroit in 1900, or Silicon Valley in 2000. In most cases, these places were anomalies that were eventually forced to conform to the norms of the larger homogeneous area. Predictably, the loss of these communities was also a portent of the rapid decline of civilizations that traded their future for the past. Today's innovation ecosystems can be anywhere on the planet. But it's interesting to note that over half of all the high-quality patents have come from innovators born outside of the U.S. or from first-generation Americans. Some survey data even suggests that immigrants are five times as likely as native-born U.S. citizens to produce a patentable innovation. We see similar trends for startup businesses. This human capital brings innovation into our country from all corners of the world. But it can just as easily go somewhere else, and the rift between the current administration and Silicon Valley makes that more and more likely. In fact, it's already happening. Research universities, the innovation engines for the U.S. economy, are facing increasing visa hurdles for students, postdoctoral fellows, and researchers. This is particularly ominous because these people are our next generation of innovators. There are innovation ecosystems in cities all around the world. Bangalore, Cambridge, Santiago, and Tel Aviv. And let's not forget Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver. Maybe we should consider building a wall between the U.S. and Canada to keep our best and brightest at home. Then again, such a wall would just likely be a colossal waste of money because these bright folks would just find a new way under, around, and through it.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business and our partner in The Next Idea. You'll find his essay at the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
We have problems at the local government level,
and we must be honest about them. We must recognize them and we must address them. We have too much legacy liability in a number of our communities. The problem, we have 334 local units that provide retiree health care and pension that have $14 billion in unfunded liabilities. A huge burden.
That's Governor Rick Snyder speaking at this year's State of the State address. So what happens when a city or a school district can't keep its promises to its retirees? The result is one of the biggest problems facing our state today and the nation, unfunded pension liabilities. Yet most people's eyes kind of glaze over when those words unfunded pension liabilities start getting tossed around. In search of a fuller understanding of what unfunded pension liabilities are and what they mean for Michigan and for workers and retirees, we turn now to Liz Farmer. She's the finance writer for Governing Magazine. Great to have you with us, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Can you please take us all through, I'm going to call it unfunded pension liabilities 101. Exactly what do we mean when we say that?
Unfunded pension liabilities basically means the amount of money that you don't have that you eventually need to pay your retirees.
That's very basic. It's like you've got a blanket and it's not long enough to cover you.
Exactly. It's the amount on the bill that you're short.
And how does this happen? What's created this problem?
A lot of people like to look at the recession and point to that as the sole reason that so many pensions have these big unfunded liabilities. But it's part of the story. The story started before that, though. Several main factors have contributed to this. Pension funds, on the whole, over the past 10 to 15 years, the investment earnings haven't been getting the investment earnings that were expected of them. So they've been falling short on their investment returns on average. They've had very good years. They've had some very bad years. But generally, people expect pension funds to earn about 7 to 8% on average every year, and they have not been doing that for the better part of two decades at this point. So that's one thing. They're not returning their investment returns. The other part is that the recession did take a big bite out of the assets in pension funds. So a lot of them dropped immediately from their funded status. They lost about 25% of their assets in 2008 and 2009. So that took a big hole out of them. And then the other part of this is that retirees are just living longer. And so a lot of the assumptions that pension funds are operating on, and they take these assumptions and then figure out what bill they need to send to the government, and the government pays the bill. Their assumptions have been too rosy. They have been assuming that retirees won't live as long as they do. Their health care costs cost more. And so a lot of this is just kind of catching up to reality. And when you're talking about government catching up to reality, they are perpetually behind.
And how widespread, Liz, is this problem across the country? I guess I'm trying to get a handle on how Michigan compares to other states.
It's very widespread in the fact that you'd be hard-pressed to find a government anywhere that is doing just great. There's certainly lots of governments that have pension funds that are pretty steady, pretty healthy. Even state governments like Wisconsin has a pretty healthy pension fund in terms of having enough money right now that it will owe its retirees down the road. But within any county that you live in, you could probably look around and find several pension funds either on the state level or city level or county level that are pretty underfunded. And when I say underfunded, I mean anything that's less than, 90 or 80% funded. There's this myth out there that having a pension fund that has 80% funded level is healthy. And actuaries will quickly point out that's not true because you need to have all of the money, not just a portion of it.
Okay. So here we are with this big problem, billions and billions of dollars in these unfunded pension liabilities. And certainly things that affects the retired municipal employees, the retired teachers. But in a broader picture, how do these liabilities hurt the city, hurt the state?
A lot of times what happens is governments are every year forced to choose with their limited funds, do we pay our full pension bill, put in the money that the pension fund actuaries say we need to put in to keep the fund growing and healthy and ultimately have all the money we need in it? Do we put all the money there, or do we invest more in schools? Do we invest more in roads? And more every year, governments are forced to really make these decisions. It's called crowd out. And it's when this big kind of debt, this long-term debt, whether it's retiree health care, whether it's bond debt, and in this case, pension debt, when the pressure to pay that then forces you to take money away from other things that lawmakers really, really like spending money on, like education and infrastructure, public parks, things that their constituents need today, not things that their retirees eventually need down the road.
One approach we've seen is cities closing off their defined benefit systems to new hires and putting the new hires into a 401k defined contribution benefit. So what are the pros and cons of doing that? How has it worked out?
The state of Michigan actually did that in the late 90s with its state plan. Honestly, even though it's been doing that for a long time, there are still pros and cons, because if you look at the retirement system for Michigan, it still has an unfunded liability on the employees that remain in the traditional pension fund, and it's like 60% funded. So just looking at that alone, you can see that closing out the plan that you have and opening up a new one that's more like a 401k doesn't instantly resolve your unfunded liabilities in your pension bill. What it does do is that it takes some of the pressure off the government down the road. Right now, pensions are structured so that all the risk is put on the government. If the stock market doesn't perform and the investments don't grow like people expect that they will, the government is on the hook for putting in the extra money that they will eventually owe retirees. Because the way that it's worked is the retiree gets a defined benefit. That means when they retire, they get X dollars every month. That benefit is defined by the amount of time they work for the government and all this other stuff. 401k just says, here's your pot of money, good luck. So all the risk then is kind of transferred from the government onto the employee. And so that's great for governments, because while it doesn't necessarily mean they will pay much less right now, it does mean that they're not on the hook if the stock market crashes, or they're not on the hook if retirees live longer. That's on the retiree.
We do have legislators in Lansing who think that this is a good approach, have tried to get this through. And so what you're saying is, yeah, when it was tried by the state, it didn't really solve the problem.
Right. The state still has a huge unfunded liability for its state employees plan. What happens is when you open a new 401k plan, that only applies to new employees. There are huge legal protections around pensions. So you can't take all your current workers and say, you don't have a pension anymore, now you have a 401k. That just doesn't work. So when the state did that, there were certainly employees who were working for the state that are still either working for the state now or are retirees that are getting their defined benefit.
We're talking with Liz Farmer, who's the finance writer for Governing Magazine, as we kind of dig into unfunded pension liabilities. And on the surface, this talk of unfunded pension liabilities and defined benefit system, it sounds dry, but this is really a highly emotional issue, because it's about promises that have been made to people who worked hard. And if these promises aren't being kept, again, emotions run very high.
That is so true. That's one of the most fascinating things to me about pension plans. Unfortunately, the word pension just sounds really boring and like something that you wouldn't understand. But when you realize this, you're talking about a person's livelihood in retirement, it becomes very, very different. And people do get very emotional about it, particularly when you're talking about teachers, firefighters, and police officers. I mean, people who either put themselves in danger's way every day, or people who are in charge of safeguarding the education of our children. When you talk about people like that and talk about doing something that would either cause them to leave the profession, because if you're not going to get a great guarantee that when you retire, you'll be taken care of, why would you stick around? You know, when you talk about it in those terms, nobody wants to do anything that would cause teachers to leave the profession or firefighters to feel like governments and their constituents don't have their back. And so when you look at it on those terms, these people are doing a public service that, quite frankly, a lot of people wouldn't want to do, and that you want to get their back in retirement and make sure that they're not going to be having to use social welfare programs or anything like that. You want them to be safe in retirement. It is a completely different picture.
Liz, so what does it say to you that so many states and cities are wrestling with this issue? I mean, did governments all across the country just make too many promises they couldn't keep? Or did our elected officials fail to provide adequate funding?
Yes to both of those. those two things, elected officials failing to provide adequate funding and making promises that they couldn't keep, those in addition to bad investment returns are the key things that explain why pensions aren't holding up the way that people thought they would. There are plans around the country, like I said, that are doing fine, but they tend to be the plans that stayed very conservative in their assumptions, that made it really hard for elected officials to try and increase benefits to retirees, and just basically stayed very simple, very straight plans. And the idea is that the pension plan should be part of this three-legged stool of your pension plan, your personal savings, and a Social Security check in those states where retirees get, where public servants get that. But what pensions evolved into, and this started in the 90s, is sort of like this tool for officials to score points with public employees. And they would add benefits, they would add retiree benefits, and they would lower the retirement age, or they'd boost the amount that you could get for your pension when you retire, and do all these things because at the time, pension funds were flush with cash. The stock market was doing great, and there was no end in sight. And so governments made these bad decisions by boosting these benefits, and then they didn't throw in extra money to pay for them. And then they continued to not pay their pension bill after that. And so that all started around the late 90s. It continued into the mid-2000s. And that's why you saw pension funds, despite the health of the stock market in the mid-2000s, pension funds still continued to decline.
Can you give us a prognosis for Michigan if it does not manage to solve this problem? What's at stake here?
Well, Michigan's going to have to make some tough decisions regarding how it spends its money. And I think what's really very difficult to do in terms of when you, especially when you're talking about teacher pensions and firefighters and police, is pensions are a recruitment tool. You use them to draw people and give them a slightly lower salary. But the exchange is you cultivate and grow that person into a dedicated employee, a trusted public servant. You know, they spend their career with you, and then they get a pension on the end of it. You don't want teachers who are in and out in like 2 or 3 years. That doesn't do your school a lot of good. You want people who are there for the long haul. And so when you talk about a 401k, that doesn't really appeal to keeping people with you for the long term and growing a public school system into something of a, you know, model school system when you have teachers rotating in and out all the time. Same thing for police and firefighter. You want continuity in those professions. And so it's very difficult to try and shift to a 401k. If they do that, you'll probably see recruitment problems. Governments are going to have to try and figure out if they can't shorten their pension bill, if they still need to pay a lot into their pension to keep it healthy, then they have to figure out what else they're going to do. Are they going to hire less teachers? Are they going to not spend as much on roads? Are they going to not build that big infrastructure project that they wanted to do? They're going to have to make cuts elsewhere, and that doesn't really fly very well with constituents.
It's like an onion. The more you unpeel it, the more layers you find. Liz, thank you so much. Liz Farmer, the finance writer for Governing Magazine, breaking down unfunded pension liabilities and really what they mean for Michigan. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You know, there's so much to talk about in this immensely diverse state of ours, and we can't possibly know about it all, which is where you come in. We want your questions, ideas, and suggestions. On April 22nd, we're going to do a stateside in Flint at the Flint Institute of Art. So, what topics do you think we should cover? What questions do you have about Flint, its neighborhoods, its people? And we're especially interested in hearing from those of you who live in Flint now. What do you think we should cover? What does the media miss or misunderstand? Send us your questions and ideas by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.